36. Phonoscopy. At noon, Yakonev himself was missing from the velvety hush and glossy comfort of his office. He was in number 7, officiating at the wedding of the Clipper and the Scrambler. The idea of uniting those two devices, born that morning in the mercenary mind of Markushov, had been snapped up by many others who saw some advantage to themselves. Only Bobinin, Prianchikov, and Reutmann were against it, and nobody listened to them. Present in the office were Selivanovsky, General Bulbanyuk, representing Ryumin, Marfino's Lieutenant Smolosidov, and the prisoner Rubin. Lieutenant Smolosidov was an unpleasant character. Perhaps you believe that there is some good in every living creature? Your search for it in Smolosidov would be rendered difficult by that unsmiling, iron-hard stare and the sour twist of those thick lips. He occupied one of the lowliest positions in his laboratory. He was little more than a radio fitter, and he was paid no more than that of the lowliest female employee, less than 2,000 a month. True, he stole another 1,000 from the Institute in the form of the otherwise unobtainable radio parts he sold on the black market, but everyone knew that there was more than this to be said about Smolosidov's position and income. The free employees in the Cherashka, even the friends with whom he played volleyball, were afraid of him. They were frightened by his face, in which it was impossible to awaken a spontaneous reaction, and by the special trust that the highest authorities showed him. Where did he live? Did he, in fact, have a home, a family? He never accepted invitations from colleagues, never shared his leisure with them beyond the boundaries of the Institute. He had 3 war medals on his chest, and in an unguarded moment had boasted that all through the war Marshal Rakosovsky had not spoken a single word that he, Smolosidov, had not heard. When asked how this could be, he replied that he had been the Marshal's personal radio operator. Nothing more was known about his past. No sooner did the question arise as to which of the free workers could be trusted with the red-hot secret tape than the minister's inner office gave the order. Smolosidov. Smolosidov was now installing a tape recorder on a little varnished table, and General Bulbanyuk, whose head was like a grotesquely overgrown potato with 3 bulges for ears and nose, was saying, "You, Rubin, are a prisoner. But you were a communist once, and you may be a communist again some day." Rubin would have retorted, "I'm a communist right now." But trying to convince Bulbanyuk of that was beneath his dignity. "So the Soviet government and our organs feel that they can trust you. The tape you are going to hear contains a state secret of world importance. We hope that you will help us to isolate this scoundrel who wants to see his native land menaced by the atomic bomb. It goes without saying that if you make the slightest attempt to divulge the secret, you will be annihilated. That clear?" "Quite clear," snapped Rubin, whose greatest fear now was that he might not be allowed to hear the tape. Having lost all chance of private happiness long ago, Rubin had made mankind at large his family. The tape he had yet to hear was already of personal concern to him. Smolosidov pressed the playback button, and the quiet of the office was broken by the dialogue between a slow-witted American and a desperate Russian, with a faint rustling in the background. Rubin peered into the mottled diaphragm of the loudspeaker, as though straining to discern the features of this enemy. Whenever he looked at anything so intently, his face became taut and harsh. It would be no good begging for mercy from a man with a face like that. After the words, in bad Russian, "Who are you? Say your name," Rubin threw himself back in his chair. He was a different man. He had forgotten that others present were high-ranking officers, forgotten that it was a long time since Major's stars had blazed on his shoulders. He relit his cigarette and rapped out, "All right, just once more." Smolosidov rewound the tape. Everyone was silent. Everyone felt the touch of the fiery wheel. Rubin chewed and mumbled the mouthpiece of his cigarette. He felt ready to burst. Suddenly he, of all people, the dishonorably discharged Rubin, was urgently needed. He, too, would have his chance to give Dame History a helping hand. He was back at his post, once more defending the world revolution. Malignant Smalosidov hung over the tape recorder like a sullen dog. Pompous Bulbanyuk, elbows on Anton's spacious desk, supported his imposing potato head in hands half hidden by his loose-skinned neck. From what stock had this impenetrably complacent breed proliferated? From the weed of commie cockiness, maybe? How quick and clever his comrades had once been. Now the whole apparatus had fallen into the hands of these people. And they were bulldozing the whole country along the road to perdition. How could it have happened? Reuben could not look at them. They disgusted him so much that he would have liked to toss a hand grenade at them then and there, in that office, and blow them to bits. But, as things were, at this crossroads in history, they represented the positive forces, embodying as they did the dictatorship and the fatherland of the proletariat. He must rise above his feelings. As hateful as they were, he must help them. Hogs of this sort, from an army group political department, had flung Reuben in jail because his cleverness and his honesty were more than they could bear. Hogs of the same sort, in the chief military prosecutor's department, had in the space of 4 years tossed a dozen anguished protestations of innocence from Reuben into the trash. Yes, he must rise above his own unhappy lot, to save the idea, to rescue the banner, to serve the world's most advanced society. The tape came to an end. Reuben crushed his dead cigarette in an ashtray. "All right, we'll give it a try," he said. "But if you haven't got a suspect, what are we looking for? We can't tape the voices of everybody in Moscow. Whose voice do we compare this with?"
Bulbanyuk reassured him.
"We picked up 4 people on the spot near the telephone booth, but our man is most probably not one of them. There are 5 people in the Ministry of Foreign Affairs who could have known, not counting Gromyko and 1 or 2 others, obviously. I've jotted down those 5 names, without initials, titles, or the posts they occupy, so you needn't be afraid to accuse any one of them."
He held out a page torn from a notebook. The names written on it were 1. Petrov, 2. Siagoviti, 3. Volodin, 4. Chevronuk, 5. Zavazin.
Reuben read the names and made as if to copy the list, but Selivanovsky hastily prevented him. "No, no. The list will be with Smalosidov."
Reuben handed it back. He was not offended, but amused by all these precautions.
As if the 5 names were not burned into his memory already. Petrov, Siagoviti, Volodin, Chevronuk, Zavazin.
Linguistic speculation had become a matter of habit with Reuben, and he had automatically registered the derivation of the names Siagoviti, Bouncy, and Chevronuk, equals Javoronuk, Skylark.
"Please record other phone calls made by each of the 5, he said curtly.
"You'll get them tomorrow.
Another thing, put the age of each by his name."
Reuben thought a bit.
"And a list of the foreign languages he knows."
Selivanovsky assented.
"I've been wondering myself why he didn't switch to a foreign language. What sort of diplomat is he? Maybe he's just very crafty."
"Maybe our man got some uneducated simpleton to do it for him,"
Bulbanyuk said, slapping the table with his flabby hand.
"Whom could you trust with a job like that?"
"What we need to find out as quickly as possible," Bulbanyuk explained, "is whether the culprit is in fact one of these 5. If he isn't, we'll try another 5, or another 25 for that matter."
Reuben waited till he had finished and nodded at the tape recorder.
"I will need the tape the whole time, starting today. It will be with Lieutenant Smalosidov. You and he will be allocated a room to yourselves in the top secret zone."
"They're clearing it now," Smalosidov said.
Reuben's service experience had taught him to avoid the dangerous word "when," in case he was asked the same question. He knew that there was only work for 1 or 2 in this, but that if you spun it out, it could be good for months. Whereas if you asked, "When do you want it?" the bosses would say, "By tomorrow morning." He asked a different question.
"With whom can I discuss this work?"
Selivanovsky exchanged a glance with Bulbanyuk and answered,
"Only with Major Reutemann, with Fomor Gurjanovich, and with the minister himself. "You remember my warning?" Bulbanuk asked. "Want me to repeat it?"
Reuben rose without asking permission, looked at the general through half-closed eyes as though he was something very, very small, and said to no one in particular,
"I must go and think."
Nobody objected. Reuben's face showed no emotion as he left the office. He walked unseeingly past the duty officer and down the strip of red stair carpet. He would have to draw Glieb into this new group. He would need to talk things over. The job would be a very difficult one. They had just barely begun working on voices. Preliminary classification. Provisional terminology. He looked forward to his research with a true scientist's excitement. This was, in effect, a new science. Identifying a criminal by a voice print. Till then, criminals had been identified by their fingerprints. That technology was called dactyloscopy, finger scanning, and it had evolved over the centuries. The new science could be called voice scanning, that would be Sologdin's term, or phonoscopy, and it had to be created in a matter of days. Petrov, Tsiagaviti, Volodin, Chevronok, Zavarzin.